are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, August 15th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. Broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Vijay Prashad, Executive Director of the Tri-Continental Institute, Chief Editor at Leftward Books, Chief Correspondent at Globetrotter. We're talking about the India's tearing up of its own constitution for a nationalist extremist project in Kashmir. Pakistan's own escalations. What is China's role in potentially pulling South Asia back from the brink? Trump's Iran absurdities. And Vijay is just back from Brazil, where we'll be talking about social movements there and the effort to free political prisoner Lula da Silva, how that is inseparable from any global struggle against all of these currents, from the United States to Brazil to India to Israel, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, they're not getting into the country. Apparently, this is a personal request of Donald Trump. I guess go back to where you came from, unless it is occupied Palestine. Kashmir cross-border fire kills three Pakistani and five Indian troops. U.S. applied to seize detained Iranian vessel in Gibraltar. The Chinese paramilitary exercises are amassing and a clear threat to demonstrators in Hong Kong. An autopsy of Jeffrey Epstein finds broken bones in Jeff Epstein's neck, deepening questions around his death, according to the Washington Post. Yeah, I would say so. A lot of questions.
Some pretty deep questions.
Some very deep questions.
To the center of the earth
to
questions.
The center. This is a time we really got to ask, is this who we are? Are we are we a global blackmail pedophilia network going back to the OSS and Roy Cohn? Is this who we are? NYPD police union boss, sorry for sharing a racist video, but don't worry, he has black friends. Children of temporary status holders fight for their parents' protections in court. The Trump administration aims to shift money for even more immigration terrorism. Stocks losses deepen as a Trump recession looms. House Homeland Security Committee to subpoena the owner of 4chan. And Jeffrey Epstein owned a picture of Bill Clinton in a blue dress.
Hell yeah.
Is this who we are? Is this who we are? Are we really a CIA orchestrated global pedophile ring with photos of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky's dress? Is this who we are?
You know, I don't mind some focus on 4chan stuff. I think disrupting outright sort of networks is important. But how was it we see subpoenas on the Epstein front?
Yeah, I don't know about all that 4chan. And I was actually, I'm planning some content with a very good friend of mine, an academic, Drew Mikhael, who's based at Queen's University in Belfast. And he does a lot of work across the globe on de-radicalization. And we were talking about how, from a social psychology perspective, there's vastly different environments, obviously. There's vastly different justifications. One would have a lot more understanding, you know, in some ways, obviously, why someone in Yemen or even years ago in Northern Ireland might engage in certain context than in somebody who, you know, is from El Paso. But the core mechanisms of how you radicalize somebody, whether it's Al-Qaeda, neo-Nazi, whatever, is similar. It's global. It's playing on sets of very different, a very similar psychological needs. And I think that conversation does need to go to the forefront more than, you know, worrying about this or that website. Although I do think it's fascinating that the owner of 4chan, I mean, I don't know if this is the current owner they're subpoenaing, but the guy who created the website regularly asks that the website be taken down. He doesn't have control over it, obviously, but he said on multiple occasions, basically, that he would prefer the thing just be taken down.
Like, the FBI has said they might look at QAnon and groups like that for domestic terrorist-related reasons. And before you start cheering stuff like that
on... Don't cheer that.
Think about the general concept of criminalizing conspiracy theories about elite pedophile rings and why that might be important to, like, sort of maintain the space for.
I've said from the beginning that... Well, and we see this in these social media things. You know, I shared no tears for whoever has been shut down or deplatformed, Alex Jones, whatever. Great. Who cares? But if you can't see a pattern of how conversation and journalism, including quite important stuff, will get shut down in that trend line, including, I always use an example, Facebook relying on essentially right-wing think tanks in D.C. to sort of establish what is and isn't credible, and the fact that they've shut down. You know, look, Telesur shouldn't be your only source for news in Latin America, no doubt, but it's an important and credible source of news, and it's going to be treated as conspiracy news because, frankly, any news that just has a South-centric viewpoint is going to get put to the bottom of those lists. I mean, this is just basic politics here. And yes, it is very disturbing when the FBI starts getting into that territory, even if it does include some people who are dangerous and terrible and stupid and all the rest. If you can't, some people, you got to sit back and have a little bit of a broader pattern recognition on these things. Or not. You could, instead of having broader pattern recognition, you could be Ben Shapiro and have the same degree of charisma and empathy in equal measure that he has, which is to say negative on both fronts. Kamala Harris has been out campaigning, and in her attempt to prove some populist bona fides, which are just bluntly not in any way deserved based off of her record, she's noting, as many candidates have noted, but as people like Bernie Sanders, of course, have been saying for years, even before it was fashionable, that a lot of Americans have to work two different jobs to basically survive. Now, of course, you could be in the gig economy. How we measure those employment rates, that adds a whole bunch of other Americans. You could be working one job and not getting paid enough. You could be long-term unemployed and off of the rolls and not even included in unemployment statistics. So even just that one metric points to a bigger structural problem of inequality and a lot of people not being able to survive.
Hey, if you work in the gig economy, you're not working a job, okay? You're an entrepreneur.
That's right. Every single person struggling to survive on an Uber shift is really just essentially Jeff Bezos in the service sector. Here's Ben Shapiro. This is Kamala first, and then Ben Shapiro is going to respond to her.
You know, he's going around crowing about how this economy is doing so well, right? Oh, the economy is great, he says, right? And they refer to the unemployment numbers. Well, yeah, I'm traveling our country. Let me tell you something. Yeah, people are working. They're working two and three jobs. And in our America, we must agree nobody should have to work more than one job to have a roof over their head and food on the table.
Okay, well,
that seems also, you know, basic and commonsensical. But here, Ben Shapiro has the same amount of problem with this rhetoric coming from Kamala Harris as he does looking at the camera in a head-on shot. And I know that I don't always maintain camera eye contact either, which I should, but this is a little bit of a different setup than Shapiro has, and there's a lot more lights going on and a lot more dynamic activity in the studio. Why on earth, if you have a static shot like this and you know that you cannot look at the camera, you would set it up like that is beyond me. But I'm sorry to lose track here of the substance. This is Ben Shapiro.
Well, the fact is that if you had to work more than one job to have a roof over your head or food on the table, you probably shouldn't have taken the job that's not paying you enough.
Pause.
That'd be a you problem.
Can we just let that sink in? In a country that we know, in a global economy that we know, is defined by structural inequities and multiple barriers to getting well-paying jobs, this kid is literally saying if you work at Walmart or something full time and you need to get another job in order to survive at the bare minimum, you should have just not taken the Walmart job. You should have just become an engineer at Google instead. That is basically what he's saying. So this is already, you know, we're already completely effed in terms of making any sort of sense here. But let's play it out.
Well, the fact is that if you had to work more than one job to have a roof over your head or food on the table, you probably shouldn't have taken the job that's not paying you enough. That'd be a you problem. Also, it is not true that the vast majority of people in the United States are working two jobs. It just is not true, according to the census.
So
she didn't say
we'll
vast
stop it
majority.
There. Yeah, she didn't say vast majority. And I would also say, you know, it the people that have to work, the whole thing about having to work more than one job is bad, but it's also the case where we just need to have people get more from the one job or the work that they do now,
right?
Regardless of if that's one job, two jobs, three, right?
Precisely.
Yeah, we don't need more jobs. We need better jobs.
We need better jobs, unions, and higher wages. But okay. So first, there's the total lack of empathy. And of course, it will surprise no one that, of course, Ben Shapiro is another trust fund baby brat who's never had to struggle or deal with anything in his life. He's got a weird, you know, he's part of this bizarre conservative obsession with like teenage, you know, with like immediately post-pubescent boys who can get up on stage and demand tax cuts and agitate for the invasion of Iraq. That's where he comes from, which, you know, look, if he had a normal psychic trajectory, he would be like that kid, Jonathan Cohn, who was actually on this show years ago. And he was just like, I don't know why adults wanted to see me as a 13-year-old talk about like why we shouldn't have gun control or whatever. That's kind of weird. I'm in college now, and I'd appreciate if everybody would leave me alone and let me grow up as a proper, fully paid-up member of the human race. But Ben Shapiro never had that growth or break, so he's basically just the same thing as he was when he was 14. He's just a kind of odd little right-wing propagandist who came from nothing but ease. So there's that obvious thing. Then there's the who gets to have jobs and why thing, which is, of course, immediately erased by this. And even though Kamala Harris didn't say most, but even if you stipulated that it was, say, between 5-6 or 8 or even 8% of the population, that is still millions and millions of human beings in this country that have to work beyond physical capacity to survive and acquire basic goods and services. We should oppose that and recognize that as a problem, even if it is not a majority. I don't really understand the sort of intellectual and moral limitations in being able to understand this. This is another great little classic of Ben Shapiro. It just shows you when you talk fast.
The same thing is like the idea that you could just.
Oh yes,
presumably
the same logic.
It's the same logic. Like you'd have to move to a different community, presumably. Like you think about all the different. Like we're worried about the right wing starting to speak to these communities in the middle of America that are getting hollowed out. Well, yeah. What are you going to do? Move away thousands of miles from your family.
Well, this is why someone like Tucker Carlson is more formidable than Shapiro, because that is what Shapiro's got. But anyways, here's Shapiro.
So it depends on what they have a doctorate in. Right, so you're right. There are a lot of climate scientists and climatologists who have said that global warming is an absolute fact, and anthropogenic global warming is an absolute fact. They have very different measurements as to how large that effect is going to be. There is a broad range among climatologists, as far as I can tell, among how much the climate is going to actually change and what is the direct impact of carbon emissions on that, given the fact that for the last 15 years there has been no global warming. The single largest study of global warming that was done in the
skip
in the
ahead a
Britain
little bit here
does not involve killing off millions of human beings. I agree. But the problem is that if you're going to provide, if you're going to make, maybe you're wrong about climate change denial. But here's the solution that you're ignoring. Where's the solution that's being ignored? Right, I'm sorry, it's not Holocaust denial. The use of the language denier is.
Sorry, this is a longer clip.
Okay, but basically, this is the infamous clip where he said, even if I stipulated that you were right about anything and you had beachfront property and it flooded, well, you can just sell it. So we all remember that classic bit of the ferocious, precise intellect of Ben Shapiro. All right, we got to take a brief break. We're going to come back with Vijay Prashad on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Vijay Prashad. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute, chief editor of Leftward Books, and the chief correspondent at Globetrotter. Vijay, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So, Vijay, can we start by discussing what's been happening in Kashmir, the Indian, the moves of the BJP government to accelerate troop presence in Kashmir, and also the tearing of the Indian constitution with regards to Kashmir's autonomy. Can you kind of historicize this for us? What has been the long-term situation in Kashmir? How and why is this an escalation? And then maybe also incorporate Pakistani and Chinese responses to this.
Thanks, Michael. That's a very easy thing to say. The first thing I think that needs to be recognized is the situation in Kashmir today is part of the unresolved business of the partition of India in 1947 by the British. I mean, the British hastened the timetable of their departure after World War II and sent a barrister, a lawyer, Sir Cyril Radcliffe, to draw a line between the two new states of India and Pakistan, and then the British sort of wrapped it up and went home. It was extraordinarily, rapid pace of events in India and Pakistan. So the state of Kashmir was a monarchy. It was a princely state. And people may not know that about half of the Indian landmass was actually not directly governed by the British, but was governed through these princely states. And so the Maharaja of Kashmir, at the time of partition, was not willing to join either India or Pakistan, at which point events hastened and some irregular troops entered Kashmir from Pakistan. The Indian government went and said, look, quickly join us so we can send in the military, and the king did this. I mean, he joined India basically under duress, but the Indian government promised two different things. One was that there would be a plebiscite in Kashmir, which was now divided between India and Pakistan. But they said there'll be a plebiscite very soon. This was pushed by the United Nations as well. That means the people of Kashmir were to be given the right to vote for their future. The second thing the Indian government did in the constitution of 1950 and through a presidential order in 1954 was that Kashmir, for now, would have autonomy in Article 370 and Article 35A. Now, why did I say for now? Because if you're going to give the people a plebiscite, a chance to chart their own path forward, these provisions in the Constitution were basically temporary until there would be a plebiscite. But nonetheless, because there's not been a plebiscite,
The special status of Kashmir has remained from 1950 and 54 till today. Suddenly, the Indian government, really quite suddenly, on the 5th of August, decided to rip up Article 370 and 35A, which removes the special status of Kashmir. And now, having done this, we have to understand the context. There are two ways, two important things to look at. Firstly, the right-wing government, the BJP government, has had since the 1940s the agenda of somehow just absorbing Kashmir, and since the 1950s of cutting these two provisions in the constitution. So for them, this is nothing new. Mm-hmm. When they won a large mandate in the election this year, it was clear they wanted to do something quite spectacular. Their base, which has really substantially grown in India over the years, has been itching for this. So there's a popular mandate in India for the scrapping of Article 370 and 35A. But in order to do this, they had to reconcile that popular mandate in India with deep resentment of this inside Kashmir. So just before they announced this in Parliament on the 5th of August, 35,000 paramilitary troops were sent into Kashmir. The troop strength of the Indian military in Kashmir is over 500,000. It's probably the most highly militarized place on the planet. The internet was shut off. The assembly, the state government's assembly had already been dissolved in November of last year, but local politicians were arrested. The media was entirely silenced. So Kashmir had no role in its own future when this happened in Parliament on August 5th. And shamefully, many centrist parties joined with the right in voting for scrapping Article 370 and 35A. So that's the, as it were, domestic context of the situation. There's, of course, as you said, an international context. Over the last 10 years or so, the Chinese have developed a project called the Belt and Road Initiative, which runs across Eurasia into Africa and parts of South America. It's quite an incredible project, that has linked the Chinese coastal cities on the South China Sea with Europe directly by rail and road through Iran, through substantial parts of West Asia. But in South Asia, in the last two or three years, the Chinese have developed two projects, two so-called corridors. One into Nepal, which was signed in 2017, and then a $46 billion corridor, which went directly into Pakistan, all the way to a port city in the Pakistani province of Balochistan, which is called Gwadar. This development by China has rattled the Indian government to some extent, but it also has very much rattled the United States government. And the U.S. government has been putting pressure on India not to participate in the Belt and Road Initiative. And it's quite clear that this Indian government, the right-wing government, being a kind of subordinate ally of the United States, towed the line and hasn't, done any kind of move to, join either the Belt and Road or to even, find a way for India to plug into that. I mean, it's an enormous infrastructural project. So there was a sense that the Chinese, Pakistanis, Nepalis, etc., in that region near Kashmir had some sort of, expansion of their project. The right-wing Indian government basically wanted to exert itself in the border regions. So they not only violated the constitution by scrapping 370 and 35A, but they, took the state of Jammu and Kashmir, abolished it, and brought that entire region, which is the size of the United Kingdom, under the direct control of New Delhi. So they have sort of centralized rule over that important border province.
When we talk about the Pakistani response, what is the distinction? There's how much autonomy does Imran Khan have as a prime minister, or is he really essentially a conduit for the intelligence and military service in Pakistan? And what is their sort of position here, both, I guess, in terms of their own sense of historical aggrievement and even things going back to Bangladesh in the early 70s, but also their own strategic calculations in terms of wanting to have some type of presence in Kashmir for their own ability to wage proxy war or counterweight India?
Well, you know, the thing is that it's hard to say whether Imran Khan has autonomy from the military or not. You know, this is a matter of rumors. People suggest that his victory in the election was entirely because the military pushed him forward. So, you know, maybe he's the man of the military, maybe he's not. He's been making some noises after this move about genocide in Kashmir and so on, which, you know, is what one would have expected whoever had been the prime minister in Pakistan. In other words, Nawaz Sharif would have said the same thing. Even, you know, Parvez Musharraf would have said the same thing, former military man who was the prime. So I don't think it really matters who is the head of government in Pakistan. All of them would have said the same thing. They would have said this is a violation of Kashmir and so on. But there's actually something underneath this that was reported by Suhasini Haider in the Hindu newspaper, which I want to point out. After Imran Khan met with Donald Trump, some statements were made, which I know Suhasini writes about it, and I can confirm it, was rattled the Indian government a great deal. Mm-hmm. What were these statements? What happened was that Mr. Trump has been eager to set a peace deal in Afghanistan, even if it means the Afghan Taliban comes back to power in Kabul. You know, he's very eager to pull the U.S. troops out. So one of the pieces of this is that there will be some sort of peace agreement in Afghanistan, and there will be a peace agreement that actually favors Pakistan. This is very important. Afghanistan not only has been part of the Cold War, let's say in the earlier period between the USSR and the U.S., in the more recent period, you know, the United States against so-called terrorism and so on. But there's also another factor, which is Afghanistan has been part of a mini Cold War between India and Pakistan. Now, what is this mini Cold War? You will know that the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan has never been delimited. It's a contested border. In fact, Afghanistan hadn't recognized the state of Pakistan. So for many years, the Pakistanis had their own agenda inside Afghanistan. They backed the Taliban in the 90s and so on, hoping to have a friendly government in Kabul. At the same time, the Indians know this is a soft spot for the Pakistanis and have backed the opposite faction. So, you know, right after the fall of the Taliban, the government that came of Hamid Karzai was very much looked towards India. He had studied in India, he had friends in India and so on. So the question of Afghanistan is a sensitive one. And when the U.S. government, after meeting Imran Khan, said that we want a peace deal in Afghanistan, and there was a suggestion that the Taliban would be allowed to come back to power, this was a concern in New Delhi. Secondly, in that press conference, Mr. Trump said, and we'll move on to Kashmir. You know, in that way that Trump says things, where it's all easy to solve. You know, today he said, she will solve the thing in Hong Kong. You know, it's just by magic wand that you can solve contradictions. So he said, we'll move on to Kashmir. This very much alerted the Indian government. And I think the timetable for their very rapid move in this undemocratic way to basically seize, put the iron fist down on Kashmir, the timetable was hastened by the press conference between Imran Khan and Trump, the statement about Afghanistan, and that very casual statement about Kashmir.
That's great. And Vijay, just please make sure to stick close to the mic, because when you do, you sound crystal clear and we get less echo. So I guess before we move on, because we also need to touch on Iran and Brazil, I'll internationalize it again in a second. But what is the presence of the Indian left at this point? We know that the last elections were a real consolidation of the far right in India. And we also know that the Congress Party, the prime opposition, we wouldn't consider to be a left party. However, maybe it would be fair to say that despite all of their own contradictions, limitations, and their own actually very bloody history at certain points, they were able to hold a certain, to some degree, some notion of Indian pluralism in place, going back to Nehru's kind of liberal conceptions. And then there's an Indian left presence. I mean, I think a lot of people have known that Kerala has been governed for most of its history by, or some significant parts of its history, by the Communist Party, and it's an achieved incredible social gains in that state relative to not even just India, but even globally in some areas, is my understanding. Where, I guess, in general, what are the sort of main opposition positions in India right now? And to what extent is there still a serious left presence, or has it all been relatively marginalized?
So the first thing to say is that the communist parties, of which there are a few, mm-hmm. and they remain strong in terms of their mass movements. The main communist party, the CPIM, it leads a government, a coalition government in Kerala even now. And there are, you know, hundreds of millions of people in mass organizations of the communist left. So communist left still exists. But I think to the point here, it was the communist left that was the only one who roundly criticized the Modi government for what it did in Kashmir and took to the streets as well on August 7th. So, by the way, at the same time, communist left plus some independent leftists traveled to Kashmir between the 9th and 13th of August, returned to Delhi. Yesterday at the Press Club of India gave a press conference where they basically summarized the situation as democracy is being murdered in Kashmir. So the left has taken a very strong position, and I would say, you know, against public opinion on this case, because, you know, the left is not going to tail public opinion. This is something people need to pay attention to, that, you know, that is why sometimes you become weaker. You're not willing to be an opportunist. You have a longer term perspective. You have a perspective about minority rights and so on. It's not popular always to stand up for, you know, minority populations and so on. So the left has been tarred with the brush of being anti-national. I think this is a serious issue around the world, where people who stand up for human rights, stand up for justice, you know, they are disparaged. Mr. Trump routinely calls the press, for instance, the enemies of the people. I mean, this is the same sort of attitude. If you don't stand with the majority, then you're a problem. You know, you're a virus. They use quite, you know, repellent metaphors to describe people who simply will not stand by the majority for its sake. So that's a big problem for the left that we should recognize. It's a global problem.
Yep.
The Congress Party, unfortunately, vacillates because it has, you know, part of its agenda is with this sort of broader, secular, you know, as you said, pluralistic India. But it also vacillates because at times it will run with the hounds, you know. It will go in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. it will say, well, we need to be with popular opinion. And I think that's quite shameful. We see that a lot with liberalism around the world.
Right.
You know, people saying, well, you know, I'm against what Trump is doing at the U.S.-Mexico border. On the other hand, immigration is a problem. Right. No, I'm afraid that's wrong. Immigration is not a problem.
Right. So, and even just in maybe just one brief history lesson that we can correlate. I mean, I like recognizing how compromised liberalism is all of this, at the same time not drawing a false equivalency. I would certainly prefer a Congress government in India. I'd prefer a democratic government, you know, generically to Trump. However, at the same time, it's so important to be honest and clear about these things. And I always remember, you know, the pogroms against the Sikhs after the assassination of Indira Gandhi. I mean, I was, you know, quite personally sort of, you know, overseen by a Congress Party government.
Oh, I was a young person in India then. I come from a Sikh family. This is entirely personal for me.
Yes.
But, you know, I don't bear any animus towards the Congress as an entity. I think it's a contradictory entity. Look, in our countries, all of them, you know, all around the world, we are seeing basically the disappearance of a robust, strong, liberal social democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, your electorate is entirely polarized. On the one side, you've got this repellent, terrible right wing. On the other side, you have a left which is weak because it stands for the truth. We need that middle ground to ally with. And that's just not available. If you look at the U.S. Democratic Party, you have people like, you know, Omar Iram, you have Rashida Tlaib, you have, you know, all these other people on the left. And even in their own party, their speaker is not always able to be in line with them. And I'm not saying they need to agree, but at least they should have an attitude of solidarity with each other. Right. And even that is not available.
Right. Precisely. And that is actually why I think it's so important that we get to Lula in Brazil in a bit, because that's such an important model. But before we move to Iran for a couple of minutes, I mean, what everybody always goes to, and in some ways, maybe this is our own international selfishness, that anytime something happens in South Asia, there's all these incredible intricacies that implicate so many people and such dynamic politics in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. But it always sort of ends up at some point of like, is this going to escalate to the point where there's some type of actual serious military exchange between India and Pakistan, which would obviously, you know, have ramifications for the rest of the world. What is your read on the appetite of the Indian and Pakistani governments in terms of actually allowing this to escalate beyond the crisis it already is?
I don't think there's any sense that there will be a war. Okay. I mean, the Pakistan General High Command has basically said so. And I also think it's important to understand that here the Chinese have changed the situation in South Asia. Mm-hmm. You know, the appetite is much greater for greater infrastructure than for war. I think that this is quite a significant qualitative change in very many parts of Asia. I feel like this is what is going to turn the clock in Afghanistan as well. The moment people in Afghanistan see that the Chinese are going to show up and build big roads and connect Afghanistan with the rest of the world, that they will see, well, maybe this is a better idea. I mean, I just want to put forward that it's been a long time in parts of Asia. It's been far too long where there's been no uniting project that is not, something to do with war. And the Chinese have, for all their flaws, put that project forward.
Right. With Iran, we've seen the Trump administration tear up the deal, even though every observer, including our own U.S. State Department and so on, confirmed that Iran was following the deal down to the T. The Europeans were angry, but there isn't necessarily any sort of muscle behind that anger. And now we've seen this kind of cycle of tension in terms of these ship seizures. What do you see as the dynamic between the United States, Iran, and Europe right now?
You know, it's related to our previous conversation about India, because again here, the Europeans are a test case of spinelessness. You know, the Europeans know that the deal that was, after a great set of compromises by all sides, the deal that was struck in 2015 is a very good deal. The Europeans know that. They tell you that quite openly. Secondly, the Europeans know that the Iranians have not violated the deal. And as you say, so does the U.S. State Department. In fact, so does the CIA. Everybody knows the deal was not violated. Thirdly, the Europeans are desperate for Iranian oil. You know, there are other main avenues for oil or natural gas from Russia, from Libya. These have been compromised by sanctions, by very stupid wars. So the Europeans are desperate for Iranian oil. You know, they tried to create a mechanism to be able to pay for Iranian oil around U.S. sanctions. So for these three reasons, Europeans know the deal was good. Europeans know the Iranians haven't violated the deal. And the Europeans are desperate for oil. You would think that in a rational world, European social democracy and so on would stand up and say that the United States leaving this deal is ridiculous. I mean, they would come beyond the United States and be sharply critical. When the U.S. government decided to sanction Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, you know, in a normal world, you'd have expected the foreign ministers of Europe and the European Union's foreign chief, for now, Federica Mogherini, you would have expected all of them to come out in public and said, this is outrageous. All that happened was they released a very mild statement saying, we will continue to meet Mr. Zarif. Really, is that the best you can do? I mean, this spinelessness of the center is what is crippling the world today. You know, we need to say this. It's easy to say, where's the left? What's the left not doing? This is not a problem of the left. This is a problem of a center that has been dissolved into jelly.
So what? And what was the rationale? I mean, just elaborate on the sanctions against Jawad Zarif, because that is really the height of the aggressiveness and the absurdity of the Trump line and the spinelessness of the Europeans. I mean, I'm not making a value judgment here. I don't want sanctions against anybody. It was a great deal. Things are moving forward and so on. But when someone pulls, you know, when someone comes forward and they say, oh, well, we sanctioned some, you know, commander in the Republican, you know, in the Republican Guard or whatever. Okay. You know, this makes a, inside a certain logic, this is sort of part of the kind of conflict zones in the Middle East. Jawad Zarif, no one has done more to try to soothe all of these tensions and move forward diplomatically.
Well, Mr. Zarif was educated almost entirely in the United States. He speaks fluent English. He's an extremely bright and well-prepared person. Let's just put that out there. You need to have Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on your show. You need to ask him why he's jealous of Mr. Zarif. You know, I asked somebody in the U.S. State Department, what's the story here? Because I wrote a piece about this. Well, he told me, look, let's be frank. Zarif has been doing the U.S. talk shows and the Trump administration is frustrated. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't stand the fact that this guy is so good. And, you know, partly, let's say it, he's right in what he's saying. It's not just that he's a good, you know, spin doctor. He has truth on his side. I mean, it's not only that he's a good messenger, his message is good. And Trump apparently and Pompeo just can't stand that. You know, in a monarchy, sometimes you have to look at the caprice of the monarch. You don't have to understand structure and, you know, you don't have to understand the context. It's just the monarch's attitude. You know, that's how I like to read the Saudi Arabian situation, for instance. You know, there's a lot of internal bizarreness. You know, when the monarch says something, you have to do it. I mean, there's no checks and balance. In some ways, this Trump-Pompeo, you know, policy on Zarif feels monarchical. There's no rational explanation to sanction the foreign minister of a country who's willing to negotiate with you. You can't on the one side say, we want to negotiate a better deal, and then sanction the only person who's able to negotiate this deal. You know, the supreme leader of Iran made a very good comment. He said, look, you know, you want to negotiate? Zarif is the only person you're going to negotiate with. There's nobody else. He right. said that openly.
Right. Right.
So the fact of this sanction on Zarif indicates one of two things. One, this government is totally comical, farcical, doesn't understand the way in which diplomacy works. They are being motivated, in a sense, by jealousy or whatever. That's one. Second thing is, actually, this is their path to war. They really don't want to negotiate anything. That eventually, when the timetable, perhaps an electoral timetable, suits them, they'll do some sort of bombing raid on Iran. It's only one or the other explanation, perhaps both. But I don't see a third explanation.
So what can slow that timetable down or reverse it? Is it dependent on the feckless Europeans? Certainly Bernie Sanders has at least been very aggressive in terms of domestic leadership and trying to bring this back to Congress as an example, as well as also saying quite clearly that any type of military exchange with Iran would obviously be an absolute catastrophe. What can slow this or stop this?
Well, I'm not confident about the Europeans. I mean,
right.
they were not able to build the spine to deal with, you know, a pack of lies around Iraq. I doubt very much that this mm-hmm. is going to be any different. That's the one side. Secondly, inside American politics, there's a serious problem. I mean, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, neither seem to acknowledge and appreciate the fact that Iran has the legal right to process uranium. Mm-hmm. You know, it has a legal nuclear energy policy. Now, I am against nuclear energy 100%. But my opinion is hardly relevant. The United States government continues to develop nuclear energy. France, you know, basically exists on nuclear energy. Until recently, Germany as well. So nuclear energy is a legitimate and legal, procedure, legitimate policy and so on. And the Iranians, through their membership in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, through their established position with the International Atomic Energy Agency and so on, they have a right to nuclear energy. And they are processing around 4.5% of uranium, not even close to the 90% which is needed for a nuclear bomb. But in the U.S., in U.S. political culture, any enrichment by Iran is seen as illegal. And I think this is the really the nub of the problem. I don't see a Democrat willing to come out there in public and say Iran has a right to process uranium for its nuclear energy project. And unless that takes place, there is no long-term solution to this problem. You know, what gives a country like the United States the right to tell another country what it can do or not do if what it is doing is illegal? This is something that Americans seriously need to think about.
You just got back from Brazil, and I've certainly used on both of my platforms extensively to talk about the political imprisonment of Lula. I think that that matters in a variety of areas quite significantly, both for Brazil and the world. So I want to get specifically to that. But first, just your broader impressions of what's taking place now in Brazil, both obviously the assault on the Amazon, on labor unions and so on, this the manifestation of authoritarianism there under Bolsonaro, but also the recent setbacks for Bolsonaro and Moro and the sort of counterweight in Brazil. What's the feeling on the ground there?
Well, firstly, it has to be said that if you think Trump is a comical character, Bolsonaro is 100 Trumps. Mm. I mean, there's an element of ridiculousness about his presidency. Even the Brazilian elite, I think, is quite embarrassed by him.
Yes.
They would like his policies. They just don't like how embarrassing he is, you know, the kinds of statements and the sort of things he believes. I think that's important to put out there. Similar, in a way, to the U.S. situation where, you know, the elite very much seem to be in line with the things Trump is doing, but they just don't like Trump's personality. I think there's something even more grotesque about Bolsonaro to this elite section. But Bolsonaro as a person and his policies is deeply polarized Brazil, and polarized it in a terrible way. Polarized it to the extent where genuinely the health of the planet is threatened. There are two major carbon sinks in the planet. One is the Amazon, and the second is the island of Papua, which is divided between West Papua, now held by Indonesia, and by Papua New Guinea. Bolsonaro has basically opened the Amazon for business. This is great for Canadian, Australian, American, Swiss companies. You know, people don't like to recognize the kind of companies, the national origin of the companies that are destroying the Amazon. But they're not so far away from the good liberals of Canada. Half the mining companies in the world are basically headquartered in Canada. You know, you'll have Justin Trudeau for all his charisma, but behind him are some quite terrible mining companies. At the University of Toronto, one of the most distinguished institutions is the Monk Center for International Studies. You know, I've been there a number of times, but the name Monk should set off, you know, bells in South America, because he was the head of one of the worst of these mining companies. In fact, Mr. Monk, is the one who started writing quite feverishly when Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela, calling him a dictator, largely because Chavez threatened Canadian mining interests inside Venezuela. So Bolsonaro is certainly, opened the Amazon for business of these multinational corporations. And this is, I think, created some pause inside Brazil. Obviously, there are labor unions who are greatly upset and so on. But I think the destruction of the Amazon has even raised eyebrows among people who sort of sat in the middle and weren't willing to take a stand against Bolsonaro. I think there is now the temperature rising of genuine concern that the activities in the Amazon are threatening the planet. I think this is really the soft underbelly of the neoliberal project inside Brazil.
I've always thought that one of the reasons that the imprisonment of Lula was so crucial was that the uncritical coverage and embracing of Lava Jato by the global media class and by liberals and so on, and this corruption rhetoric, which has been used by the global far right not in terms of understanding systems of corruption, but in this personalized campaigns of saying that particular leaders, almost always on the left, are corrupt, was the sort of handmaiden of this new rise of authoritarianism. And Lavajato was so perfect because this uncritical embrace of this sprawling investigation, which was weaponized essentially primarily to focus on the Workers' Party. And now we know from all of the Intercept disclosures that, of course, it was politically motivated, and also that there were specifically politicians on the right and in the center that they went easy on or ignored because they perceived them as being politically aligned with them. And juxtaposing that with the fact that Lula was both such a successful leader but also such a conciliatory one, is your sense that that sort of the microcosm of the Lavajato Lula story in Brazil is sort of that type of stand-in for understanding these dynamics globally?
Well, first, I think let's quickly say that when Mr. Lula was in power in Brazil,
yes,
it was a double-faced agenda. On the one side, Mr. Lula decided to compromise with the banks. Mm-hmm. That was early with his letter to the bankers and so on. So he was never going to pursue a far-left agenda.
Right.
Secondly, importantly, he produced one of the most robust social democratic agendas in a big country in our period. You know, Brazil is much bigger than a place like Venezuela. And the two parts of that project that I think need emphasis, one, he basically, through his policies, almost eradicated hunger in Brazil. Incredible for a country that has never had a revolution. I mean, after all, Brazil was created not by some, you know, uprising inside Brazil, but because the father essentially donated Brazil to his son. I mean, that's hardly a revolution. And secondly, Brazil just, you know, got rid of slavery just a few days ago.
Yep.
You know, so in that context, he was able to tackle the question of hunger. I think that's quite significant. And even the United Nations said that their scheme, the zero hunger policy, has got to be emulated. Secondly, Lula opened up universities, opened a whole bunch of public universities around the country, basically opening the door to working class, rural, black, indigenous students to come and study at the highest level. And they basically came in with, you know, ability to come and study with government funds. I mean, why is this important? You know, a whole generation was able to be educated that came from deprived backgrounds. And not just primary education, they got college education. So even though there were great limitations in Mr. Lula's agenda, he pushed a couple of projects at least, and I'm just emphasizing two of them, that built him up as an enormously popular person. And it's unfortunate that his success for Dilma Rousseff came to power when commodity prices fell. She tried to push some of the same schemes, but not with the same robustness, which is why after the horrible presidency of Mr. Temer, much more corrupt than Lula, proven to be more corrupt than Lula, and Lula, we're not sure whether he was corrupt in the first place, but this man genuinely corrupt. In the time of Temer, when the next election was coming up, Lula was put as the candidate of the Workers' Party, and by all polls showed that he would have won maybe even in the first round of the voting.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to be removed from power. I mean, you know, you got to understand, when you look at the Intercept conversations, you look at Moro talking to the prosecutor and so on. I mean, behind all that is the fear that this man could become the president again. And, you know, he may not have challenged the banks. He may not have done this and that and the 100 things you can say about him. But he certainly improved the well-being of Brazilians. And they loved him. And they would have elected him without a problem, which means the left would have come back to power in Brazil. This would have been so significant, you know, for South America. Just the other day, there was a primary election in Argentina, where Mr. Macri's party was defeated, and Dilma Rousseff sent out a tweet immediately saying that this primary election in Argentina is a light at the end of the tunnel for South America. Imagine if Lula had won the election. It wouldn't have been a light at the end of the tunnel. It would have been a light over South America.
Precisely. And I just, in the last couple of minutes, I mean, I just want to say, I think it's extremely important that, especially in the Brazilian case, but elsewhere, that we make a distinction when we talk about corruption, because I think that just as with the banks, when Lula came to power in 2003, there wasn't a historical or global context for him to do much different than what he did, as far as I understand. And he still, as you said, delivered these incredible gains for the Brazilian people. And part of that was making peace with both with Brazilian politics, the Brazilian banks, foreign investors, and so on. So I think it's quite important when we sort of juxtapose these corruption questions, and we could see that, well, there's the actual case against Lula that they put him in jail for is farcical, right? It's modest improvements on a middle-class home that he was never even proven to have lived in and spent maybe one or two visits at, right? And that more broadly, you know, if someone is head of a government and has already made enough sort of innate compromise in order to govern, that might mean that they are involved in sort of broad, systemic, generic corruption. That certainly does not mean, and I think what most people think in their heads when they hear the word corruption, that, okay, someone took several million dollars out of a fund for clean water and stuck it in a Swiss bank account. There's nothing like that on Lula. And I just think it's quite important because so many right-wing leaders, even Donald Trump, you know, very effectively said drain the swamp. And in his case, he was talking about people like the Clintons who do have, you know, these are no Lulas by any stretch of the imagination. But the right has been able to use a simplified, dumbed-down corruption discourse to as political lawfare against the left, politically, particularly in Brazil. And it just seems to me that we need to have a much smarter understanding about precisely what corruption is and isn't. I mean, we saw the same dynamic in Argentina. The main argument that people like Macri had was against Cristina de Kirchner, who's running as vice president in that election. She's a former president. And they also, you know, sort of asserted corruption allegations against her as well. So I think we can't separate those threads.
Well, in fact, to come back to India, the BJP first won the election in the previous Lok Sabha with the idea that the Congress was corrupt. I mean, corruption is a very empty word by itself. It is just bandied about. I'm not sure people think about what it means. Generally, what I think people suggest is, I am not doing well in my life. It appears that some people are doing well, and therefore there is corruption. You know, corruption stands in for a better understanding of how capitalism works. You know, that is why people feel like, oh, corruption is a real thing. You know, corruption is a real thing, but it's not this sort of personal corruption you imagine. It's the system that is corrupted wealth towards a few people away from you. But we don't have this deep understanding of how the system works. So what you get is, you get the media just picking on people. I mean, let's take apartments. You know, Lula is said to have had an apartment, very modest apartment by the ocean. Let's take apartments. One of his predecessors, very famous president of Brazil, has an enormously expensive apartment in a major avenue in Paris. Why isn't that being investigated? You know, the current president of Ecuador, a great friend of the United States now, Mr. Moreno, has a very fancy apartment in Madrid, in Spain. That was revealed in some papers that were leaked earlier this year. You know, suddenly these are not taken up as cause célèbre of corruption. So corruption itself, on the one hand, is misleading because it basically gets at the problems in the world, but then deflects from the problems. You don't get a broad structural understanding of why there's inequality in the world. So that's one of the problems. Second one is it's weaponized. It's used against certain politicians and not others. And it's this weaponization of corruption that I think we should be very careful about. I mean, it's obviously true that the Clintons are corrupt. But what about the head of the Senate? You know, what about that gentleman? Comes from the state of Kentucky. Supposedly had a modest bank account years ago, now has an enormous wealth. How did they get wealthy? You know, that's also a form of corruption, perhaps. But there is no weaponization of the idea of corruption against him. This is very strategically done, and that should make us extraordinarily suspicious.
Right, precisely. And just to echo that gentleman, Cardozo, who has the apartment in Paris, some of the Lavajato leaks show at the very least that I believe Moro saying, well, this is a guy that we shouldn't look at quite as much because he's politically sympathetic to us. And so, yeah, so we have exactly precisely that dynamic. And then all of a sudden, a person like Lula, where there's actually nothing, there are no fancy apartments or secret bank accounts or anything like that. We have this silly, modest apartment deal, which doesn't have any physical evidence. But then, this sort of broader swirl of accusations, none of which have been proven. And the ones that, you know, that may exist have to do with just making compromises with a structural corrupt system, as you mentioned before, which would require an understanding of wealth concentration of Brazil and the role of global capital in Brazil. And then all of a sudden, we're in a totally different politics.
Exactly. And that politics is what we have to, you know, bring into the present. I mean, part of the problem with politics is that the context to have a sober conversation is not available. You know, people often say, oh my God, we live in these horrible times, these dark times, and so on. Well, I agree with you. But part of being in this dark time is that what I think of as a rational discussion about politics, the context for that is just not available. I mean, I'm not even talking about the fact that if you go on a mainstream television program, they don't understand what you're saying, you know. But what I want to emphasize is that they don't understand what you're saying. You sound crazy. You sound crazy, not because you're crazy, but because the context for that conversation is just not available. You know, if I want to go on a television channel and talk about, you know, the structural problems in our world, the problems of, as you said, structural corruption and so on, I don't think they have 2 minutes for that. You know, they just sort of brush you off and say, let's get back to the real question. Is Lula guilty or not? And that's not a question, man. I mean, I've been on a lot of media, but that's the question they ask you. Answer the question, is Lula guilty or not? And if you say, well, he's not guilty, then they're like, well, why is he in prison? I mean, this is not a conversation.
Right.
It's an interrogation.
Right. That stops us from actually thinking out the actual context. Well, Vijay Prashad, I just always appreciate your time so much. I hope we speak again very soon. I feel like it's been too long a gap, man.
Yeah, let's talk more often.
Okay, great. Okay. Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute, chief editor of Leftward Books, and chief correspondent at Globetrotter. Check out all of his work. We'll have a link to his Twitter page as well. Vijay, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. All right, folks. Let's see. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority. Can you take it down, Matt? I'm going to call into the system. Thank you. Majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Let's do, since we're running late, let's do thumbnail pitches. Let's do 10, 15 seconds each. Matt, what do we got?
A literary hangover we did for a couple of patron episodes before we go to Chicago. So coming up this weekend, it's going to be George Orwell's Shooting an Elephant, which is actually a rather problematic essay where we get into Orwell, maybe not so clearly good of an anti-imperialist as people like Christopher Hitchens might suggest. We get into some racial, basically racist attitudes and representations and what it means. And to a certain extent, it's defensible in terms of rhetorical. Like he literally was a cop and speaking as a imperial cop, and that's going to be racist. But nowhere else does he represent. So we get into problematic Orwell in the next literary hangover.
Sweet. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we have on Simone Norman, actress, comedian, and commie organizer in DSA, for a bit of a chat. I talked about the DSA convention in Atlanta, including the resolutions on open borders, sex work decriminalization, and Bernie or Bust, as well as the manufactured drama that was Clapgate. I also talked about the Close the Camps action in New York over the weekend and how you can get involved. And then we discussed the uses and abuses of irony on the left. Check it out. Also, we have a bonus coming out on Friday for our patrons in which Simone discusses, for the first time, the Praxis video that broke the internet. Stay tuned.
I feel like Sam on that one. It's like, I don't know all these things.
Oh, you well, didn't see the video.
I actually did not see that video.
I'll play it for you later. It's funny.
Okay. On TMBS on Tuesday, we talked with Elaine Yu. She's a correspondent for AFP in Hong Kong about the context for the uprisings in Hong Kong. Then Brianna Joy Gray, press secretary for the Bernie Sanders campaign, former TMBS regular in her journalist days. We talked about media bias against Bernie, how that campaign looks on the ground. And we did a look at ideology as a filter for understanding the presidential candidates. And when someone tells you they're not ideological, why that is the most powerful statement of ideology possible. This weekend, Liz Franzik, who is the co-host of the True Anon podcast, joins me to talk about an actual strategic response to Tucker Carlson. That's for patrons. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We'll see you in the fun half. On the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What?
Come on!
What? What?
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.